morning, Your Honors. I'm Greg Utkin here for Tenneco, and with me at the council table is Brian Garrison and Ann Frew. We're here on a case that's about a determined group of employees who, over the course of 32 months, became increasingly dissatisfied with their union and who ultimately became union free. It's also a case about an employer who tried to act responsibly after what the board called a long, contentious, and divisive strike, and who later honored the request of its employees to withdraw recognition from the union after receiving a petition signed by 76% of them to do so. After a multi-day trial, Judge Shamwell found that the petition was legitimate and that Tenneco legitimately withdrew recognition from the union. The board reversed the judge on most of those key points involving the withdrawal. Now, the crux of this case is the withdrawal and the application of what's known as the master slack factors. When a petition is filed and there are pending unfair labor practices, the burden is on the board to show that the unfair labor practices caused the employee's disaffection and led them to file the petition. And here, I'm going to assume for today's argument that the unfair labor practices occurred, because the judge found, although there were no unfair labor practices with respect to certain of these, even assuming there were, the company properly withdrew recognition. So I'd like to focus on three things. Why, even assuming the unfair labor practices occurred, they didn't meet the master slack standard. Secondly, why the board's theory does not fly factually. And third, why the testimony of the petitioners, the people who signed the petition for withdrawal, should have been given significant weight, but unfortunately it wasn't.
So the board's response to your argument is that you present one way of looking at what happened, which the ALJ in part agreed with you, but the board majority did not. Now, you state our standard of review here, and what specifically are you relying on for us to conclude that we owe no deference to either the board's ultimate conclusion, much less its findings of fact?
Well, the courts also have to look to the record for evidence that detracts from the board's
conclusion. I'm looking at your page 15, and you cite Schaefer.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I'm
saying what specifically? The board has the majority has a different view of what went on.
And what I'm saying is the evidence they looked at precluded significant evidence that supported the judge's decision, and in fact ignored many of his credibility findings that the union and the board challenged, but the board said they were not going to overturn credibility findings.
To what extent did the ALJ make credibility findings with respect to the withdrawal?
With respect to the withdrawal, I guess that would be in primary part the testimony of the petition signers, who explained why they were driven to sign the petition and seek to ask the company to withdraw recognition.
And what was the counter-credibility finding of the board with respect to withdrawal? In other words, what's the clash between the ALJ and the board?
Our view is they just ignored that.
Ignored what?
The fact
That the people who testified are telling the truth? What did they ignore? That the ALJ said that the people who testified were telling the truth? Is that what was ignored as a credibility finding?
I guess that would be one way of putting it. Yes, these people said, here is why I signed that petition. And they said,
did the board ignore that as a matter of credibility, or say, even if they said that, it's irrelevant?
Right.
Well, I guess.
Well, don't guess. It's pretty critical to your case. That's the way it looked to me. It looked like the board didn't second guess any credibility determinations, but said that given all of the other factors and the forces operating, it didn't make any difference.
They said that did not outweigh what they saw as the hindrance on the union's ability to communicate.
Right.
So they said that did not outweigh the hindrance.
A lot of your argument really, it matters whether we agree with you that some of these underlying ULPs are silly and don't exist, that the board's findings with respect to them make no sense on the record using a substantial evidence standard.
Well,
so you started your argument by saying, let's assume all the ULPs were indeed properly found as ULPs.
But correct.
The strongest way to argument, if you're right, is that they don't have all of the ULPs that they claim they have. And their findings, because you do have underlying credibility findings with respect to some of those ULPs. If you remove some of those ULPs, which involve credibility findings, the board is in a very weak position with respect to the ultimate conclusion there was causation that clause that justified the that didn't justify the withdrawal.
Correct, and you are right, and we argued in our brief that the judge was right. Those unfair labor practices did not occur, but he said even assuming they did.
I understand that, but what we're trying to go through the ULPs that you think are the weakest in the board's findings.
Well, there were, I guess, four.
Right.
One was the write-up of an employee called named Helton during the strike with respect to a shirt he was wearing.
Right.
At first said, don't be a scab. They said, would you please put a tape over the word scab? He did, but then wrote something about...
Yeah, we know the facts. Yeah. So,
right.
All
right. And so that, and
a credibility finding on that?
I don't recall any on that one. And so our view is, well, he was not disciplined for the scab, but for the insubordination for the subsequent two events. The second would be the request for addresses, home addresses.
Mm-hmm.
And there, this goes back to many of the petition signers, several of them had said, I did not want my address given out, and here's why I didn't want my address given out. And also, the union witnesses testified, our view is the union officers were in the facility and had access to the 16 or so replacements. They could talk to them every day. They could see them.
So the board looked at other evidence in evaluating the judge's finding in that regard. And I guess we're back to, was it rejecting the judge's credibility finding or simply looking beyond to other evidence?
Well, I guess it goes back to them saying that they didn't have a good reason not to give the addresses, and we said, well, these people told us, and they had testified also at the hearing, that we did not want our addresses given, and here's the reasons we didn't want our addresses given, and the judge credited that.
Is that in your brief? You acknowledge you're the board's supposed to look at, you know,
right.
All the evidence, so the board did and said, you know.
See, the board, I mean, I'm not sure, is that your argument about the addresses? Is that, did your whole argument turn on that, that is that, that the employees didn't want their addresses given out?
No, you were also saying they...
Is that your argument?
There wasn't any diminished accent, is what you're saying.
Right. The whole theory of the board was the company, by engaging this conduct, basically shut off our access, and we could not have direct communication with these replacements.
But this is, you're talking about, these are members of the bargaining unit, right? So this is information that's presumptively relevant, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so what's the error in the board's conclusion that you didn't show enough to overcome that presumption?
Well, one of the errors we say there's two different tests. There's a board test and the other one that the circuits have recognized, clear and present danger and totality of the circumstances. And under our view, under either one, and the key fact there would be.
Wait a minute.
Sure.
Let's assume that we think that we owe the board a certain amount of deference in terms of how it interprets the statute, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear and present danger test is an interpretation of the act, right? And so let's assume that we think that we owe deference to that, and that's the board's test. Now tell me your argument. Under the clear and present danger test.
On January 26, the union told the company, if you don't bring strikers back and you keep replacements, there will be trouble and conflict. The next day, the union says, we give up the strike, we want to come back, and we would like to have the home addresses of the replacement workers. So it's our view that close nexus plus the long and divisive strike that the board characterized the strike as, was a clear and present danger of misuse when they had just said the day before, there's going to be trouble.
I'm going back to Judge Rogers' questions about our standard of review. Assuming the premise of my question, that is that we're operating under the clear and present danger test, mm-hmm. I realize you have a very different view of what this record shows, but the board concluded that there wasn't a clear and present danger.
Well, counsel, let me add to this now. Yeah, I thought the second part of your argument, you've got to finish up your argument, I think. Right. I thought you were saying, all right, assume there was a technical violation. They came in after, and it is true that if they come in after a strike and they're there, they're normally entitled to names and addresses. Mm-hmm. And I thought what you were saying, you started to say it, then stopped. All right, assume it's a violation. But that doesn't equal causation.
Correct.
Which justifies the board's finding that what the company did resulted in the petition because they had access to this little itty-bitty unit of 16 people and they had access continuously.
That's correct, Your
so
Honor.
So one doesn't equal the other. So you may have a violation of the addresses. Right. It does not equal their finding on the petition was somehow improperly accepted.
Particularly since the theory of the board is you basically muzzled and shut off
right.
the contact. And we say, what could be more direct contact than you have your four union officers back in there, you have a small unit, they come to work every day at the same parking lot, they come and they work, it's a small plant, people move around, they work side by side, they have breaks, they have meals, they have after work, the union is told you can use your bulletin board. In fact, Tenneco affirmatively, after they ask for the addresses, said, well, you know, we have concerns about the addresses, but you are free to talk to any of these people at work. You are free to talk to them during their meals and break periods. You're free to use your bulletin board and say whatever you want. You're free to invite them to your union meetings and say whatever you want. In essence, they could have handed them a document that they wanted to mail to them, and that is direct contact. And they said,
what
you had no direct contact.
What about the board's reference to the testimony by union members that because of the February 6th statement and the letter, that they were fearful of talking about the strike and unionization for fear of loss of their jobs?
Two things. One, that is something that Judge Shamwell discredited.
Right. I was he said, wondering when you were going to get
I discredit their testimony. And if you look at the actual facts, people were, you know, both union witnesses and company witnesses testified. The union talked to me about the strike and why, you know, it was good to be in the union. And we posted notices on our board about meetings. And so the actual facts showed there was this communication going on. And that was probably why the judge said, I don't credit these folks.
Let me make sure on that, because I was wondering when you would get to that. It's in your brief. I thought there were disputed credibility findings on this alleged new rule about the bulletin board, and the ALJ
credited Mr. Courts on that.
And there was credibility determination as to whether what he said to them about the language being read out of context.
Right.
You shouldn't say something to provoke
right.
a response.
Those are the other two.
That was the other credibility. And I thought the ALJ said, essentially, that's absurd. That wasn't a threat. You read it out of context.
Correct, and those were the other two ULPs the judge said didn't
right.
happen, but even assuming, and you're right, he said, look, it was the first day back after the strike, and we have strikers back, we have permanent replacements in there, and just a week earlier, the union said, there's going to be trouble if you have permanent replacements in there, and we have crossovers. In the plant manager himself was a former union employee there and a union officer.
Many years ago.
Well, but he knows how this whole thing works, and he said, I was afraid I had a powder keg in my hand, so in his view, I want to do the responsible thing and then face it right up front and say, hey, folks, I know you all had your different opinions, but we're here to work, we're here to respect each other's opinions, and that's what I'm asking from you, so don't go around threatening, intimidating, and then the word evoke a response. And the judge said, well, wait a minute, I found him very credible, and when you look at that in context, that's not...
When you read the whole sentence.
Right.
Yeah.
And then as to the posting, which was the final ULP, the board alleged, well, there was a rule that says you couldn't post anything, letters, written material, without the company's permission, and I think it said unless otherwise agreed or something like that. The company showed, we've had that rule in effect for 20 or 30 years, almost verbatim. And both before and after this February 6th, employees posted things on the board. The union posted things on its board. And what he was talking about was an earlier situation where Mr. Helton had come to the company and said, hey, this coworker has posted this word about me being a mole up here in my locker area, in my work area. I want those down. And we took them down. And he said, that's what I was talking about. If you think you're going to be posting something in your work area, you better talk to us. And then, as I said, finally, what could be, if the whole issue is causation, what could be more important evidence than the testimony of the people who signed? We had long-term employees testify, new employees testify, crossovers testify, strike replacements testify, former union, and to a one, they said nothing the company did caused us to do this. Basically, it was either the conduct of the union or our personal beliefs, many times to strikers. My father was, pardon the French, screwed by the union, therefore I've not for unions. I've always done better without a union. And they said, that's why we signed the petition. And it's our view, why shouldn't that be, significant, if not determinative, as to causation, if that's what the board has to prove? And I see my time is up.
The board sort of comes back and says, as I understand it, as you point out, your manager, your client's manager, mm-hmm. was a former union person and clearly could have said, of course, you know, a vocal response doesn't in any way limit your Section 7 rights to talk about unionization, et cetera. So there are many ways to clear up things, and that under the board precedent, any ambiguity falls against your client as distinct from the union.
That rule is correct, but of course our view would be it was not ambiguous because it's all in the same sentence and talked about it, threatening, intimidating, and I suppose.
Well, the proponent in his testimony said, well, if they talked about the union, that would have come within the strictures of the rules. I mean, at least his own testimony raised some question about what that message meant.
I think he said it probably could if it was in the nature of intimidation.
No, it's broader than that. It's quoted in the brief. So I'm not, you read it, I'm sure. It's broader than that. So the board cites its precedent that says, you know, where it's ambiguous as
right.
to whether or not it would interfere with Section 7 rights.
And I understand that rule, but as I said, our
right.
view is it's not ambiguous, and the judge credited Mr. Kortz on his testimony.
Well, he credited him, but could he ignore Mr. Kortz's own testimony?
No, certainly he should consider the testimony. I mean, obviously the judge heard all the testimony, saw the witnesses, their demeanor and how they felt, so obviously that was something he heard and didn't think that carried the day.
Mm-hmm. So I just want to be clear.
Sure.
If an ALJ, there were other ULPs that you didn't mention in response to Judge
mm-hmm.
Edwards' question. Is that because you think they have nothing to do with the withdrawal or?
Well, I think they had nothing to do with withdrawal, as I said, and even if they did occur, they're not of the type that the board has said, you know, causes someone to say, I want to get rid of my union. Those have always been, there's been threats, I'm going to fire the union ringleader, I'm threatening to shut down the plant, I'm unilaterally taking away wages and benefits. Those are all these very onerous personal adverse actions taken against people as opposed to, well, I'm not giving the union this information, or I'm using the word evoke in this context of a bigger presentation.
Well, the board and intervener point out Mr. Helton was fired, and then he was brought back after he grieved, and then he was harassed. That was their word.
Yeah, that's their argument, and the answer is yes, there was a charge filed, which we settled on a non-precedent-setting basis, non-admission, and brought him back to work, so I don't think the fact that he had been terminated and there had been no findings to, you know, the legitimacy of that should be.
All right.
There. Thank you.
There was no 8A3 disposition on health, and was there finding on
no.
dismissal?
No.
Well, I missed
it.
It
was grieved.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Greg Lauro for the board, seeking full enforcement of the board's order. My opponent seems to have touched on all or most of the board's findings, but I will start with the board's finding about the withdrawal of recognition, since that was his initial focus. It's the board's position that it reasonably found, based on substantial evidence, that the company's violations here caused or would tend to cause disaffection among the employees, such that the company's withdrawal of recognition was unlawful. And in so doing, the board considered all the relevant facts. It considered the passage of time between the violations and the withdrawal petition, but noted that given the tendency of these kind of violations to have a lasting detrimental impact, that the passage of time alone did not dissipate the impact of these violations.
You know, counsel, go ahead.
Part of petition's argument is these aren't the hallmark type violations on which the board has previously relied. And here you have this almost a year, 10 months.
It is true, but the board explained how the nature of these violations would affect employees. You're cutting off the union's effective means of communicating.
Well, you're not. Assuming the home address is a violation, you're talking about a tiny unit. I mean, the board is entitled to deference, and I strongly believe in that, and I've written many opinions saying so, but sometimes the board writes something you read and it's incomprehensible. And I'm going to be very honest so you can address my concerns. This is incomprehensible to me on the withdrawing part of it. You have a request for home addresses. Normally, I think in this case, because they asked for it when they came back, they're presumptively entitled to it. But when you now use that in connection with causation, you're supposed to think about, well, what really happened there? Well, what really happened there? We're in a context of 15, 16 people. They had continuous access to them. There's nothing to suggest they were denied access to the employees. So if there was a ULP, the impact insofar as the causation analysis is minimal to nothing. And I don't see anything in the board opinion that makes any sense of that. The new rule, I must say, I don't get it. There's a clear ALJ finding, and the ALJ looks correct. And so as a judge, one of the things I look to is you can't reject the credibility determination. If it looks like on the record substantial evidence, you're just wrong. And the words out of context is bizarre. I mean, and that's one of the ULPs that's undergirding your causation violation. Those words, what the board focuses on the last three parts, the last three words, he said not to engage in taunting, verbal or physical threats, or other conduct that is confrontational or meant to evoke a response. You take him in context, he was saying, hey, you know, let's be nice. We can't be killing each other. He wasn't saying I'm against the union. And so I don't even know that that's a ULP. And why is counseling Helton, who was clearly trying to cause problems? I am nothing against unions being able to promote their views. Helton's was clearly trying to cause problems in the workplace. So the company quietly said, could you please not do that? Why is that a ULP? Okay, so now can you address those concerns? And I don't know how they equal, assuming all of them, I don't know how they equal causation, which goes to the question on the recognition, 10 months afterwards, long afterwards, in light of board case law. I don't know how you get there.
Your Honor, I think there were a lot of questions there, so I will try to address all of them.
I want to line them up for you. Go ahead.
I appreciate it. I will start with the violation about the new rule that employees shouldn't say or do anything to evoke a response. Let's start with
that's
the
not
facts.
That's not what it was. That's not, if you're going to say it correctly. That's not what he said.
Okay. On the first day strikers returned to work, he held a meeting. He reminded them of their different status in the strike, and then he told them not to engage any taunting or threats or other confrontational conduct or other conduct meant to evoke a response. Now, given all of that language, and I'm acknowledging all of it, what did that mean? The phrase evoke a response can have a much broader meaning than threats.
It could, but in context, it doesn't appear to, and the ALJ didn't think so either.
A couple of things, Your Honor. First, the board found that a reasonable employee could think that evoke a response would mean something broader than threats and taunting.
They all came in and testified to the contrary.
I know, Your Honor. I'm trying to go through all of the board findings.
I'm just telling you, it's just so not obvious. Go ahead.
No, I understand what you're saying. When when Mr. Kortz issued this directive, he didn't help employees out by giving any definition of evoke a response. And I submit that, as we sit here, the phrase evoke a response, what does that mean? It could include protected conduct like vigorous debates about the union. And although Mr. Kortz's feelings on what that meant isn't dispositive, he did testify and he did say, well, you know, I guess employees could think that they could get in trouble under this rule for discussing the union if it led to an argument, or that in order to avoid running afoul about the union, they better be very careful talking to each other about it in case the other person they talk to doesn't like the union. So for what it's worth, Mr. Kortz read the rule broadly and did read evoke a response as potentially much broader than simply saying don't fight, don't threaten each other. And in terms of what's really important, what the employees were told.
No, I think he said, I suppose you could say that. He was an honest person, obviously. That's all I took it to mean. But if you look at the words, it says, or other conduct that is confrontational.
Or.
Or other conduct of the sort that we're talking about. Engage in taunting, verbal, or physical threats. That was the premise. In context, that's what he was talking about. And then when asked on examination, I said, well, I suppose you could read it more broadly, but that's not what it says.
It says threats, confrontational conduct, or evoke a response. And it puts pressure on, what does evoke a response mean? Why even put that in there?
And
what does it add to
threats? Evidence of the pressure? Were they not allowed to use the bulletin board? Were they not allowed to talk to the union while the union was there? Did the employer somehow discourage that?
Your Honor, a Section 8A1 violation does not require proof of actual coercion or motive.
You're right. But my point is, my concern is whether or not the board has supported the judgment that there was causation between these alleged ULPs and the ultimate petition brought in by the employer. And I don't see it. So it does become relevant. What happened after that? Was the employer now really being a tough nut and saying, you better not talk? You better not use the bulletin board. You better not do anything that looks pro-union during this 10-month period?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. And I apologize. I was trying to answer both your questions, both about whether this violation is supported and the board's interpretation of this rule is supported, as well as its causal impact. And I wanted to get to the other.
Okay.
But I just wanted to first clarify that this finding of a violation for this ambiguous rule is supported. It's at least a reasonable view of the record. And I wanted to point out, you know, when we were going about what does evoke a response mean in context of the whole statement, and that how this could capture protected activity, when the rule was announced, no definition was given, no examples of protected conduct that would not fall within the rule were given, and no examples of unprotected conduct that would fall within the rule were given. And that's probably why Mr. Kortz acknowledged, yeah, this rule's
pretty
broad.
Do you think that what he said somehow suggested they couldn't continue to use the bulletin boards they'd always been allowed to use?
I don't know about the bulletin boards, but it certainly suggests that they'd better be very careful discussing the union.
All right, and then I come to my next question. During the 10 months, was there anything to suggest that, in fact, I understand you don't need that for the 8A1, but was there any, because this goes to the causation, was there anything, in fact, to suggest that that's really what the company had in mind? Forget whether there was the 8A1.
Okay, Your Honor, looking at, I know you want to talk about the withdrawal, and I think it's very important to look at all of the facts the board looked at in finding that there was a causal connection. And I know you don't agree with all of it, and you have questions about all of it, but I want to lay it out there for the court to set up your evaluation of the facts the board relied on. There was the refusal to provide the contact information of the replacements, who were a majority of the unit at the time. That hurt the union's ability to communicate.
Oh.
Because the union couldn't communicate with these employees in a manner that was private or not monitored by the company. And now I know
That's the argument that's in the intervener's brief. All right, the union has to decide how it's going to communicate, whether it wants to do it publicly in the employer's facility or whether it wants to do it privately, et cetera. And it's degrading to the union. It has to go through a third party or something like that.
It's not just whether it's degrading. It's whether it's harmful to the union's ability to communicate in this particular context. And what I mean, yes, there was a strike and there was some divisiveness. Would the company's cutting off communication, inhibiting communication, A, cause disaffection because it makes the union look ineffectual.
See, that's what I found troubling about the intervener's brief. There's no evidence that all communication was cut off.
None.
But I don't think it should be required that all communication...
The 10 months matters.
Yeah.
The board matters big on the case law. It matters.
I understand, but the board's theory, and I just want to be clear about it, I understand you might not agree with it on the record, is that although there was 10 months, at the same time, the board felt that these multiple violations inhibited the union's ability to communicate with employees in a way that would last throughout the period because these were unremedied violations.
This is so not hallmark violations. Some of them really are. I won't minimize them because it's part of the law, but they are. What I will say is they are so not hallmark violations that would justify this result. They don't come close to the kinds of cases we normally see.
I understand what you're saying. I just want to be clear about the board's theory, which is that all of these intrusions on the union's ability to communicate not only could cause further employee disaffection, but it would inhibit the union's ability to talk openly with these employees to address their reasons for not wanting the union and to inform them of what the union's bargaining strategies actually were. And what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is this is a case where the solution to the problems and the tension in the relationship would be more communication, not less.
Did the employer accept the collective bargaining agreement?
The employer unilaterally implemented its own proposals.
Did they continue to negotiate with the union during this period?
I don't know what continued negotiations there were.
Is there anything in the record to suggest that they were disdainful of the union and the union's position during this period?
I think their violations show that they were just...
No. Is there anything else that indicates they refused to interact with the union during this period? Because my reading of the record suggests quite the contrary, that they were solicitous and they were prepared to continue negotiating with the union, allowing the bulletin boards. Now, did I miss something?
I'm not saying Your Honor missed something.
Okay.
I'm just trying to fairly represent the board's view. Okay. You've got it right. The board found that these violations were ongoing, unremedied, and lasting, and would have a strong likelihood of causing disaffection among the employees, but even worse, would prevent the union from having a fair and meaningful opportunity to really talk to these employees and address their disaffection. And that's the real kicker here. When you look at the employee testimony, the replacements were asked, for example, if this union represented you, should they be able to contact you to tell its side of the story? And they said, yes, if. They just didn't even understand that this union represented them at the end of the strike. That's how far apart communication had fallen. I believe that's some of the impact of cutting the union off at the knees and its ability to communicate. They also said, and I mean the replacements, when asked, why don't you want this union? You know, do you understand his bargaining strategies? They admitted, I really don't know much about his bargaining strategies, why the union struck, what happened during certain picketing. These were employees who would benefit from more communication with the union. I think the lack of it did cause disaffection and prevent the union from addressing it. Now, I know my time's technically up. I know we have a lot of other questions about violations, but I mean, I think they're all supported. You know, you mentioned the violation with Mr. Helton, who was disciplined for wearing a protective message, you know, for bearing a protected message on his T-shirt. It's admitted that his protected conduct was a motivating factor. The question becomes, did the company prove it would have taken the same action even absent his protected conduct? I think here the facts are very clear. They issued a written warning that says, you're being punished for wearing this no scabs message. And they say, no, it was something else. It was for goading. It was for drawing employees out. But what they're really saying is, we think other people wouldn't like your message. We think other people would be goaded by it. That's why we're disciplining you. But
The use of scab is not protected in all circumstances.
Not in all circumstances.
Okay.
But there were no circumstances here that justify his pinging his right to bear that message. And I think, you know, the things the company points out that, yes, it was a divisive strike, replacements were used, but these are common circumstances in strikes. If that was sufficient to curtail employees' rights, then their rights wouldn't mean much. Also, the cases they cite where it was lawful to limit, say, wearing a button saying no scabs were very different. We're talking about situations where a union official said, I'm going to hunt down every strike crosser like the economic animal that he is, or where there were actually strikers firing guns into the homes of non-strikers. I hope we can at least agree that we don't have those kind of facts here. The cases are distinguishable. But, Your Honors, although...
Right, we don't have hallmark violations here.
I know, and I don't understand that the board is being required to find hallmark violations in every case, but the question is, you look at the reality of the situations and how would employees be affected by these violations? And I think the board explained that, given their lasting impact, employees were deprived of an atmosphere where they could freely consider whether they desired to continue being represented by this union. And I think that is fair under the facts, given the nature of these violations. You did inhibit implant communication.
How?
You told employees that you...
You're talking about disengage? That's it?
I'm talking about...
That's your evidence of inhibiting interactions between the employees and the union. That one statement, which I keep saying is out of context, but you say it's not out of context, so I'll take your reading. That's what you're resting on.
I'm resting
on... For 10 months, employees were now fearful and were unable to interact with the union because of that. And the union was prohibited from interacting with them and prohibited from using the bulletin board.
I think the question is, for 10 months, are the employees' statement of a desire to not want this union reliable when for 10 months they were subject to these violations? And there are four of them. You might not agree.
They were not subject to the violations for 10 months. That's the point. That's why I'm asking you, what are you relying on? You're relying on the one incident where you took a statement out of context and you say that means for the following 10 months, this has a lasting impact. That's what your argument is.
I'm arguing that...
Is that what your argument is?
The board found that the cumulative effect of all four of these major violations was that for 10 months, the employees' views of the union were likely caused by these violations or exacerbated by these violations, because they go to the union's ability to communicate with employees to address their concerns.
And the employees' testimony to the contrary is irrelevant.
No, it's not as reliable, because it's unclear. Are you saying this because of the way the union was cut off at the knees and because the union never had a chance to talk to you and express its views? Now, I think that claim is credible when you go back to what I said a few minutes ago. These employees said, oh, if this union represents me, they should be able to contact me directly to tell my side of the story. They didn't know the basic fact that they were represented by this union, and I mean before the petition. And they acknowledged that they didn't even really know the union's bargaining strategies. This is the effect of cutting off communication. These employees weren't fully informed. It's not just about the union. It's about the employees' right and need to make an informed decision. They didn't get an atmosphere that allowed that here, Your Honor. And I know you disagree with the violations, but it's the board's view that that rule was ambiguous in context, and that Mr. Quartz himself acknowledged that in his testimony.
On the bulletin boards?
No, no, sir. I'm referring to the rule.
Yeah, the February 6th.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And as to the bulletin boards, you know, I would just point out, again, Mr. Quartz, his own notes say, things that will be changing. Rules for posting on bulletin boards. This was a unilateral change, and it was unlawful because they didn't negotiate. But I don't want to take up too much of the court's time, but I just want to point out, you know...
I know there's sort of an interesting situation where the employer has a rule, it isn't enforced, and then they say they're going to enforce it.
Yes.
And that's a mandatory subject of bargaining.
Well, they had a practice of allowing open posting without prior approval, notwithstanding this rule.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't just change that practice without bargaining. It may have been a different situation had they actually imposed the rule in the past. But I know I've taken up a lot of the court's time, but I just want to point out it's the board's view that its decision to apply this clear and present danger test is reasonable, and that the company failed to meet its burden of proving a clear and present danger here. I just wanted to see if the court had any questions about that. And otherwise, I thank the court for its time.
Thank you. Counsel for intervener.
May it please the court. My name is Steve Jokic, and I represent the intervener in this case. I think the issue that is most important to the court has to do with the statement that the plant manager made on the day that the four strikers were returned to work on February 6th. I have to say that if you're a striker and you've just lost a strike and you're back in the plant and you're outnumbered You're going to listen carefully to what a plant manager has to say about what you can do and what you can't do. And if you listen carefully to the statement that the plant manager made, he did not have to put in the last phrase, a vocal response from a coworker, in order to make his point. They had a plant rule that says you can't intimidate or coerce people. He went a step further, and he said, don't do anything that will draw somebody into a conversation.
No, confrontation.
A vocal response is the term that he used.
It says confrontation. I'm looking at the words.
It says...
or other contact that is confrontational. Or meant to...
It says conduct that is confrontational or meant to evoke a response from a coworker. And I see those alternatives. It's like telling a lawyer to go to the Court of Appeals and present a skeptical bench and say, don't say anything that'll draw the bench out so that you could persuade them. And that's exactly the message that he was sending to people.
That analogy, at least, it goes right over my head.
The workers who were at the meeting all testified that the way that they took it was to not talk about the labor dispute. And the judge didn't find that those statements with respect to Quartz's statement were not credible. He made a finding on the bulletin boards, but not on how they took his statement of what the rules of discussion would be. And Mr. Quartz testified that the purpose of his statement was so that people didn't discuss the labor dispute on the plant floor. Now, there's still a contract to be negotiated. And if the union's going to have any prayer of negotiating a contract, they have to be able to talk to the people that they represent. And where they can't talk to the people they represent, they can't negotiate a contract. And if you can't negotiate a contract, then disaffection will follow certainly from that.
Schultz, I'll ask you the same question that I was asking the government's attorney. Assuming all of that's true, that is that there is some smack to that statement, even though some of it's lost to me, but it's debatable. How does that convert to, for 10 months, everyone was quivering?
I think it converts.
Especially when there's no evidence to indicate that the union leaders in that little itty-bitty operation were somehow had their hands tied and were foreclosed either from using the bulletin board or from talking with people.
I think the problem, Your Honor, is that the union leaders, in effect, honored what was told to them to do. They didn't go out and interact with people.
Let me make sure now we're talking about the same thing. The record indicates, and the board relied on what you're now saying, that is because of this statement, the union leaders testified, and it was not disputed by anyone, that they didn't do anything. They did not interact with anyone in the plant. They had no conversations about what they were doing. They were simply stopped in their tracks, and they worked continuously for 10 months. That's what the board found?
The evidence in this case.
Did the board find that? Is that the basis for causation? No, wait. Let's do it. You can add what you want, embellish it, but answer my question. Did the board find that?
The board didn't find
they
anything
did not
with
find
respect
that.
To what happened
during
in the 300 days of those 10 months
exactly.
On a day-to-day basis.
Exactly.
Each of the workers who heard the statement testified that they thought the statement meant be quiet. And Mr. Gray said that the impact of the statement on him was to keep to himself. Mr. Cognata said the impact of the statement on me was that I talking about the union was frowned upon. Mr. Flannery said that the impact of the statement was that I shouldn't talk about the labor dispute. Now, the fact that we don't go on a day-to-day basis and go through who pushed the envelope, who was willing to risk discipline in that environment,
I don't think undermines the board's argument.
Because
what your argument is, I'm just asking, did the board find anything to suggest, because they got testimony from the union, that they were not able to interact with these employees in that little itty-bitty operation?
Well,
there isn't any such testimony, and the board didn't credit it. Didn't credit any such thing.
And the reason why there isn't any testimony is the people honor the company's edict.
No. That wouldn't foreclose the union leaders from testifying in the board proceeding that here's what happened. We couldn't interact. We didn't interact. We never did.
I mean,
did the board find that that's what they said and they credited that? Did the board find that?
I don't think the board made a finding on that specific point. But the evidence in the record certainly supports the argument that they did, and they had a good reason.
Can't make that finding.
Well, if the question is this conduct that could reasonably lead to disaffection from the union, then the board's conclusion that this is the type of conduct that has that effect is certainly supported by the evidence in this case.
The problem for me has been from day one, there's a 10-month gap and it's long, and you're talking about a very small number of things, and it's not self-evident to me that causation is there. And so it's really important to me to know what the board thought mattered during those 10 months.
What mattered,
the board didn't make any findings.
What mattered was that people got from the statement that they weren't supposed to talk to each other, and then were told that they couldn't communicate with people in other ways either because they couldn't write a letter. They thought there were restrictions on the bulletin board. And as a consequence, during the period of time when they had to persuade people that the union is a good thing so that they could negotiate a contract and remedy the disaffection, they weren't able to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for petitioner.
A few quick points, points made by counsel. One was on this EVOCA response, and I would point out that one of the union witnesses and former officer testified when asked about what did you take Mr. Courts to mean. He wanted everyone to get along and didn't want employees to take anything into their own hands because people have emotions and sometimes let their judgment run away with them. This is how a union witness testified he took the statement. Also, as to whether the union felt we had to stay quiet and couldn't say anything for 10 months, the judge said, as to the employees' response to Courts, it seems that while some employees, most notably returning strikers, felt their right to talk about the union or the strike was curtailed by Courts' announcement, I do not credit them in this regard. The returning strikers and replacement workers, in fact, interacted and talked with each other and on occasion addressed not only the union in their conversations, but also the strike, as well as other terms and conditions of employment, all without management's intervention. To the extent...
Did the board discredit that credibility determination?
No.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I mean, that's why I've been asking this question.
Right. And to the extent the union claims, well, these people didn't these people didn't understand what their rights were. Well, whose fault is that? If the union could have talked to them, walked up to them any day, said, here's what your rights are, none of that happened. We would ask that the court deny enforcement because Judge Shamwell got it right.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.